Hi, my name is Michael Bolden. I'm the founder and executive director of the 10th Amendment Center. If you and I were to sit down and talk politics, I'm pretty sure we'd quickly find something to disagree about. On the other hand, we'd just as quickly find something we see eye to eye on. What's more important, though, is the fact that what most people want to accomplish in Washington, D.C., almost never happens. Sure, sometimes you get part of what you want, but it's almost never the real deal. Just think of the anti-war activists who helped elect a so-called peace president only to have new wars in their name. Or the conservatives who helped elect a so-called small government president who expanded federal power over almost everything those people wanted left to the states. And all of us, we all ended up with a series of presidents who have expanded surveillance powers beyond anything George Orwell ever dreamed of. They read your emails, monitor your phone calls, track your location through your cell phone, and even your license plate. And that's just scratching the surface. Let's face it, while the establishment media would have you believe the so-called other side is always about to take over and destroy everything you love, this is just a tactic to keep you stuck in a rut that never gets anything accomplished. They're all bad, and virtually all solutions both sides give you are bad too. In the series of short videos to follow, I hope to share with you the tools you need to get done what you want to get done. And here's a little hint to start. Stop everything you've been doing, or not doing for that matter, and throw it in the trash. It's not working. We're going to start from scratch with a new approach that's actually been around for a long time. To stop the feds, people generally try three things. Vote the bums out, sue in federal court, or demand Congress repeal the law they passed in the first place. But if you want to succeed, you should do something else. Think of the Constitution like you would an owner's manual for something in your home. While some of the jargon might be a little confusing, if you have questions, you should go to the people who wrote it for clarification. Sure, James Madison doesn't have a toll-free number or live chat, but the man considered by many to be the father of the Constitution wrote plenty about how to stop the federal government when it won't follow the document he was so instrumental in writing. In a paper known as Federalist Number 46, James Madison told us exactly what to do. He provided a blueprint of sorts, a series of actions to effectively stop the feds. But what Madison did not advise might be even more notable than what he did advise. He never told you that your first or primary strategy should include the three things people normally do today. That is, voting bums out, suing in federal court, or demanding federal politicians repeal federal laws. None of these were part of what James Madison advised as a first response to federal overreach. Did you know the man considered by many to be the father of the Constitution gave us a blueprint for what to do when the federal government doesn't follow the rules? Well, he did, and it's not something they teach you in school either. When ratification of the Constitution was still up in the air, James Madison and others wrote a series of papers about how things would work. In one, Federalist Paper Number 46, Madison laid out a clear plan, a blueprint for what was needed to keep the federal government in check when words on paper wouldn't do the job. Surprisingly, James Madison didn't advise using as a first response to federal overreach what are known as the most vaunted parts of the American system today. That is, voting bums out, suing in federal court, or demanding that federal politicians repeal their own laws. Instead, James Madison advised a series of four actions by individuals and states. 1. Protest on a large scale. Madison called it disquietude of the people. 2. Noncompliance. Madison recommended disobedience in general and a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. 3. Outspoken governors. Madison advised what he called frowns of the executive of the state to build awareness in the general public. And 4. State legislation. Madison said legislative devices should be used in the states, that is, passing resolutions or bills as needed to counter federal power. James Madison told us that using these steps together in multiple states would be extremely effective against the federal government. He wrote that doing so would present obstructions which the federal government would be hardly willing to encounter. This advice was written in a time when the federal government did very little. Today, when the federal government is active in nearly all areas of life, James Madison's blueprint will have far more impact and success than it did in his day. That's because Washington, D.C. relies on support and cooperation from the states for almost everything. As the National Governors Association put it, states are partners with the federal government on most federal programs. Partnerships don't work too well when half the team quits. In other words, if individuals and states protest and refuse to participate on a wide scale, there's very little the federal government can do about it. While James Madison wrote the most specific and complete set of instructions on how to stop the federal government without going to the federal government, he was far from the only founder to talk about states as a check on federal power. A little-known founder from Massachusetts made the case, just like James Madison did, that the states were the strongest check on federal power should they work together to oppose it. Theophilus Parsons wrote that the state legislatures were superior to all the parchment checks that can be invented. In other words, no matter how you try to balance federal power among various federal branches, they're all still part of the same entity, the federal government. And if you have a problem with the federal government, you need something outside the federal government to stop it. Parsons taught us that this mechanism is the states. And when they're organized in opposition against federal acts, he wrote that none but madmen would attempt a usurpation. Even Alexander Hamilton agreed. In Federalist No. 28, he wrote that state governments would offer security against invasions of the public liberty by the national authority. The common thread from Madison to Parsons and even Hamilton is that states are an essential part of the checks and balances of the Constitution. They are a counteracting force, especially when two or more branches of the federal government work against us. When states take action, they're extremely effective as a roadblock to increasing federal power. Thomas Jefferson agreed. In 1798, he wrote about state resistance as the rightful remedy. In 1798, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison penned the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions, formally articulating the principles of nullification for the first time. During the summer of 1798, Congress passed four laws, together known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. These laws represented a gross exercise of power never delegated to Congress. In response, Thomas Jefferson drafted the Kentucky Resolutions, and the state legislature passed a revised version of them on November 10th, 1798. Asserting that the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government, Jefferson proclaimed that nullification was the proper response to deal with all federal overreach. In his original draft, he wrote, where powers are assumed which have not been delegated. A nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. That every state has a natural right in cases not within the compact to nullify of their own authority all assumptions of power by others within their limits. That without this right, they would be under the dominion, absolute and unlimited, of whosoever might exercise this right of judgment for them. On December 24, 1798, the Virginia Senate passed similar resolutions penned by James Madison, further asserting not just the right, but the duty of states to step in and stop the federal government. He wrote, "In a case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them." Taken together, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions lay out the principles of nullification. That is, state-level resistance as a duty to stop federal power. Taken together, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798 outlined the principles of nullification, but they didn't actually nullify anything. In fact, they were intended as just a starting point. On November 17, 1798, 1 week after passage of the Kentucky resolutions, Thomas Jefferson sent a draft to James Madison along with a letter. He wrote, "I enclose you a copy of the draft of the Kentucky resolves. I think we should distinctly affirm all the important principles they contain so as to hold to that ground in the future and leave the matter in such a train as that we may not be committed absolutely to push the matter to extremities and yet may be free to push as far as events will render prudent." A return letter from Madison to Jefferson, recorded in Jefferson's journal as received on December 20th, has never been found. However, on December 24th, 1798, the Virginia Senate passed resolutions, penned by Madison, further asserting not just the right, but the duty of states to step in and stop federal overreach. Taken together, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions lay out the principles of nullification, but they did not actually nullify the Alien and Sedition Acts, or anything else for that matter. These non-binding resolutions merely made the case for nullification and called on other states to join them for further action. Correspondence between Jefferson and Madison tells us they didn't plan to stop with a mere statement of principles. They were building the foundation for something greater. As Jefferson wrote in his letter, the goal was to push the matter as far as events will render prudent. Understood in this correct historical context, the resolutions provide an invaluable blueprint on how to stop federal power today. In 1798, Thomas Jefferson wrote that nullification was the rightful remedy for federal acts outside the Constitution. But what did that mean, and how do you nullify? When Thomas Jefferson told us that every state has a natural right to nullify federal acts outside the Constitution, he didn't say how to do it. In fact, even though a few decades later some of his most prominent supporters claimed to base their own nullification process on his advice, he never in his life actually gave us step-by-step nullification instructions. So is Jeffersonian nullification just an abstract philosophical concept? Did he leave us totally in the dark? Well, he did leave a pretty serious clue about how to nullify in his draft of the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. In response to the hated Alien and Sedition Acts, he called on each state to take measures of its own for providing that neither these acts nor any others of the general government, not plainly and intentionally authorized by the Constitution, shall be exercised within their respective territories. In short, Jefferson advised a whatever-it-takes approach with nullification. Part of that approach involved smart strategy. In a letter to James Madison, he advised against just pushing the issue to the extreme. Instead, he suggested they push as far as events will render prudent. Think of it this way. If your neighbor blocks your driveway with his car, you're probably not going to walk over to his place and punch him in the mouth as your first response. And trust me, you shouldn't, even if you want to. In life, situations have to be addressed individually, and the response must be appropriate to be successful. Taking things too far might put you in a place where you will never be able to get the job done. Sometimes you have to be tough and strong, and other times you have to be smart and savvy. That's exactly what Thomas Jefferson advised for nullification. While supporting nullification as the rightful remedy, Thomas Jefferson told us the goal is to prevent federal enforcement, but that each issue must be addressed in a manner that's effective for the situation. Did you know there are two primary definitions for the word nullify? Knowing the difference is essential for putting it into practice. Nullification can be defined in two primary ways, like these from Merriam-Webster Dictionary. 1. To make null, especially to make legally null and void. 2. To make of no value or consequence. The first is the legal definition, ending the force of something in law. For example, a court might nullify or invalidate a contract between two people. The second definition is the practical one, ending the real-life effect of something. This is not very different from the way nullification was understood at the time of the founding. One of the leading legal dictionaries of the 18th century defined a nullity as that which renders something of no legal force. On the other hand, a number of well-read 18th century dictionaries defined words like nullify, nullity, and null as something rendered ineffectual. The lesson is this. If a law is passed and no one follows it, or it can't possibly be enforced in most situations, is it really a law at all? Think about that the next time you hit the gas pedal when there are no cops around. One of the best examples of how to nullify didn't come from the 19th century, and it has nothing to do with slavery. It's happening now, and it's about a plant called marijuana. In 1996, the people of California passed Proposition 215, the Compassionate Use Act. This authorized the possession and cultivation of marijuana for personal medical use in defiance of federal prohibition. You see, federal law doesn't recognize medical use for marijuana. This plant is illegal in all situations, all the time, according to every branch of the federal government. When Prop 215 passed, the message from the Clinton administration was the same. We don't recognize your state law. Attorney General Janet Reno said, "We want to make clear that federal law still applies." An LA Times article dated January 97 repeated the same message, noting that federal officials vowed to pursue California physicians who recommend marijuana for their patients. The threats from the Clinton administration didn't stop people in California, or other states for that matter. And by the end of his term, 7 states authorized medical marijuana in defiance of federal law. From there, the Bush administration ramped it up, taking a hardline public stance, asserting federal law ruled the roost on weed, conducting roughly 200 marijuana raids in states over his two terms. And in 2005, the Supreme Court also affirmed this uncompromising federal prohibition. Those actions didn't stop the trend in the states either. By the time Bush left office, there were 13 states defying the feds on marijuana. From there, the Obama administration ramped it up still further, conducting more raids than Bush and Clinton combined. And at the time of this recording, there are currently 23 states defying the feds on marijuana, with four of them legalizing for the general public. Even in the face of increasing federal enforcement measures, the states found the winning path. It's only a matter of time before they overwhelm federal enforcement capabilities completely, and the feds will have to act like they've decided to drop the issue just to save face. What's the message here? When enough people say no to the federal government, and enough states pass laws backing those people up, there's not much the feds can do to force their so-called laws, regulations, or mandates down our throats. In 1850, President Millard Fillmore signed the Fugitive Slave Act into law, prompting abolitionist northern states to attack this unjust law with nullification. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 counts as one of the most reprehensible laws in American history. It denied a black person accused of escaping slavery any semblance of due process. A white man could basically drag a black person south into slavery merely on the power of his word. This even put people born free in the North under the constant threat of being snatched up and sent to slavery. But rather than wait for Congress or the federal courts to overturn it, Northern abolitionists used every tool possible to resist it. The most famous example was the Underground Railroad. But abolitionists also used state nullification to help stop the enforcement of this federal act. On November 13, 1850, the Vermont legislature passed a bill known as the Habeas Corpus Act. It required the state to protect and defend any person in Vermont arrested or claimed as a fugitive slave. The Michigan Personal Freedom Act prohibited the feds from using state or local jails for the purposes of holding an accused fugitive slave and made any attempt to send a freedman south into slavery a crime. A Massachusetts Personal Liberty Act called for the removal of any state official who aided in the return of runaway slaves and disbarment of attorneys assisting in fugitive slave rendition. Another section authorized impeachment of state judges who accepted federal commissioner positions authorizing them to prosecute fugitive slaves. Famous abolitionists publicly supported these efforts. John Greenleaf Whittier said, "So far as that law is concerned, I am a nullifier." And William Lloyd Garrison supported him when he wrote, "The nullification advocated by Mr. Whittier is loyalty to goodness." By creatively denying much-needed support and resources to the Federal Fugitive Slave Act, states were extremely effective at stopping it. In the end, almost every northern state enacted laws which either nullified the Fugitive Slave Acts or rendered useless any attempt to enforce them. Northern states were so effective at nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 that they were successful even in the face of a threat to use the U.S. military to stop them. Under the provocative headline, "The Administration and Nullifying Vermont," the Memphis Daily Eagle, in its lead editorial for December 18, 1850, reported on the Vermont Habeas Corpus Act, a bill to block enforcement of the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. They noted the president and the entire cabinet were determined to enforce the fugitive slave law in Vermont if it required the whole military force of the United States to do it. The threats didn't scare Vermont into submission, and while that state was first, a dozen other states joined them with similar acts, usually referred to as personal liberty laws, in the coming years. With just a few exceptions, the Fugitive Slave Act went totally unenforced in New England. Over the 10-year period of 1850 to 1860, there were only 4 documented cases in which fugitive slaves were returned from New England, the last being a man named Anthony Burns from Boston in 1854. By creatively denying much-needed material support and resources to the Federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, northern states were, according to South Carolina, Mississippi, and Texas, extremely effective at nullifying it. On December 5, 1933, the 18th Amendment was repealed by the 21st Amendment, ending alcohol prohibition. What most people don't know is that state and local nullification created the atmosphere where this repeal was inevitable. After the 18th Amendment, nearly every state passed laws to enforce prohibition under the Volstead Act because it was widely accepted that they had an obligation to do so. The state of Maryland, however, never passed any laws to enable state-level enforcement and was eventually joined by other states, starting with New York in 1923. A study from the University of Houston noted that states eventually grew tired of the hassle that came with enforcing the federal alcohol ban. In fact, by 1925, 6 states had developed laws that kept police from investigating infractions. Cities in the Midwest and Northeast were particularly uninterested in assisting the feds with prohibition. And by 1928, 28 states had stopped funding for alcohol prohibition enforcement. Add to all this the millions of individuals who flat out defied federal law. Prior to prohibition, there were fewer than 15,000 legal bars in the United States. By 1927, more than 30,000 speakeasies were in business, and approximately 100,000 people brewed alcohol illegally from home. During that time, Maryland's Senator Bruce recognized what was happening. He noted that even though national prohibition went into a legal effect, it had never gone into practical effect at all. New York Mayor LaGuardia agreed when he said, "It is impossible to tell whether prohibition is a good thing or a bad thing. It has never been enforced in this country." It wasn't for a lack of trying on the federal level, but individuals, cities, and states resisted on a massive scale. In some cases, they even prohibited prohibition enforcement. In the end, the federal government was unable to overcome this effective, practical nullification and was eventually forced to repeal. Nullification does not rely on federal courts overturning a federal law, and sometimes states win even when federal courts are against them. In the 1850s, northern states passed a series of what were known as personal liberty laws intended to thwart federal efforts to return escaped slaves to the South under the Fugitive Slave Act. President Fillmore even threatened to use the army against Vermont to force the issue. In the days following secession, the state of South Carolina pointed out the results by noting that northern states rendered useless any attempt to execute the federal law. Fast forward to 2005. The Supreme Court held in Gonzales v. Raich that federal laws banning marijuana use and possession were in effect even in states that permitted it. At the time of that opinion, there were 10 states that authorized marijuana for medical use. Instead of repealing those laws in the face of a federal court opinion, all 10 states move forward with their programs anyway. In the years since, that number of states has more than doubled, with 4 states going even further to allow the use of marijuana for recreational purposes, like alcohol. As more states take these actions in the years to come, it's likely that the feds will have to give up on marijuana prohibition completely. What's the point? Well, people worked for years in the legal system to stop both federal laws. And when Congress and the courts wouldn't do the right thing, those people made strategic moves to stop them anyway. That's why we define nullification like this: any act or set of acts which renders a law null, void, or unenforceable. The end result is this: when enough people say no to the federal government, and enough states pass laws backing those people up, there's not much the feds can do to force their so-called laws, regulations, or mandates down our throats. Defeating federal acts with state-level resistance is like a chess match. An aggressive attack might be exciting, but slow, steady, and strategic usually wins the game. Some people say all states need to do to stop the feds is arrest the federal criminals. They want to see states pass nullification laws declaring a particular federal act unconstitutional and imposing felony charges on any federal agent that violates the state law. Precedent does exist for states arresting federal agents who break state law in the course of enforcing federal acts. We know of at least three cases involving the arrest of federal marshals trying to round up fugitive slaves in northern states during the mid-1800s. Vermont even passed a law making fugitive slave rendition a kidnapping offense. But despite these bold actions, we've never found a record of any state successfully prosecuting a federal agent for simply enforcing a federal act. Expecting states to successfully arrest and prosecute federal agents is just like a full frontal attack in a game of chess. But anyone who knows the game recognizes that the most aggressive moves are often the most reckless ones, especially if the opponent has more firepower than you do. On top of that, in the current political climate, there's no indication that any state legislature in the country is willing to pass such a bill. No indication that any governor would sign such a bill. And no indication that state and local law enforcement would actually put such a bill into effect. Sometimes it's better strategy to lure your opponent into a trap. When they overextend, it's far easier to bring them down. The federal government has overextended in many areas, and states can pull the rug out from under it without an OK Corral-style standoff. To stop federal acts, James Madison recommended a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. Over 170 years of Supreme Court precedent supports this strategy, too. Known as the Anti-Commandeering Doctrine, in four major cases dating back to 1842, the Supreme Court has held that the federal government cannot require states to use personnel or resources to help the federal government carry out its acts or regulatory programs. In the 1842 Prigg case, Justice Joseph Story wrote that the federal government could not force states to implement or carry out the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. He said that it was a federal law, and the federal government ultimately had to enforce it. In the 1992 New York case, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that the feds cannot commandeer the legislative processes of the states by directly compelling them to enact and enforce a federal regulatory program. In the 1997 Prince case, the court held that the federal government may neither issue directives requiring the states to address particular problems, nor command the state's officers or those of their political subdivisions to administer or enforce a federal regulatory program. And in the 2012 Sebelius case, the court held that the Constitution has never been understood to confer upon Congress the ability to require the states to govern according to Congress's instructions. This mirrors what James Madison advised in Federalist No. 46, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union as an effective strategy to stop the federal government. In a time when federal power is far more overextended than it was back then, this is no mere footnote from the father of the Constitution. This approach is not just legal under modern Supreme Court precedent. It's not just constitutional according to the founders. it's good strategy. Plain and simple. Some people want states to nullify by arresting federal agents. But in today's political and legal climate, there's no way for this to work in practice. Under modern legal precedent, any case involving a federal agent acting within the scope of their assigned duties gets removed to federal court. On top of it, there currently isn't a state court or state government in the country that's willing to tell the federal courts to pound sand when it comes to charging a federal agent with breaking state law. In other words, the structure of the legal system today makes it nearly impossible to prosecute a federal agent in state court or enforcing a federal law. So how would this play out in practice? Let's say your state passed a law banning the enforcement of federal gun laws or federal marijuana prohibition, and this state law included felony charges for any federal agent trying to enforce the federal law in question. In the highly unlikely scenario that your local police or county sheriff actually arrested a DEA agent for raiding a marijuana dispensary, or an ATF agent for enforcing a gun law, here's what would happen. Lawyers for the federal agent would immediately make a motion to remove the case to federal district court, and the state judge would comply. Once in federal court, federal agents almost never get convicted for enforcing federal law. In fact, a federal agent once admitted to committing burglary while participating in a sting operation. The judge let the agent go because the agent claimed he committed the crime as part of the undercover operation. Because of these facts, in almost every legislative committee in every state of the country, any bill with provisions to arrest federal agents will almost always get voted down. In the off chance that such a bill passes an early stage, it's almost certain to never become law or come into actual practical effect. Unless there's an historic change in the makeup of state governments, these types of measures are a strategic waste of time. Instead, you should focus on different strategies that work. Civil disobedience and non-compliance are not just for individuals. By withdrawing support and resources, states have a powerful tool to stop federal acts. American history is filled with stories of heroic individuals defying government laws. From Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad to Susan B. Anthony and Claudette Colvin. Even the father of the Constitution, James Madison, advocated resistance to unjust laws. As Madison put it in Federalist 46, when a number of states pass laws directing state agents to refuse participation in a federal act, coupled with individual disobedience on a wide scale, this creates a climate the government would be hardly willing to encounter. But that was then, and this is now, right? Wrong. In Madison's time, the federal government was so small no one alive today would recognize it. And even then, withdrawing consent by refusing to participate on both an individual and state level was effective against federal acts. So today, withdrawing support and consent is far more effective. Think of it this way. Doing the dishes sure is easier if you have one person washing and another person drying. But if your partner stops helping, you can still get it done without too much trouble. On the other hand, try moving a couch up a flight of stairs and into a dorm room without help. You might pull it off on your own if you're really determined, but you're not going to want to do that ever again. Today, the federal government is huge and involved in nearly everything. It relies on our help more than ever. A statement from the National Governors Association confirmed this. They noted states are partners with the federal government on most federal programs. Partnerships don't work when half the team stops participating. By withdrawing support, states can effectively bring down most federal programs. Weed. Nearly two dozen states circumventing federal prohibition has exposed a serious Achilles heel, which proves that nullification by noncompliance works. In late 2013, just before Colorado's new recreational marijuana law was set to go into effect, the federal government sent a warning shot across the bow. They conducted the largest marijuana raid in Colorado history, hitting more than a dozen dispensaries in the Denver metro area. This led some people to take the position that state laws legalizing marijuana in defiance of federal prohibition would never really work because, as they put it, the feds can simply come in and shut it down anytime they want. Others said that marijuana proliferated only because the president had been so supportive of the states. Both views are easily refuted with some simple facts. Let's review them. In less than two full terms, Barack Obama conducted more marijuana raids than his two predecessors, George Bush and Bill Clinton, combined. He tried to stop the states from defying federal law on marijuana, but was faced with insurmountable resistance. While the feds, in theory, can still shut down marijuana dispensaries, they don't have the money to investigate and raid every dispensary, especially if state law prohibits local law enforcement from assisting them. It costs the feds about $25,000 to physically raid a single marijuana dispensary. It costs up to $1 million for the lengthy investigation that often leads up to a raid. The annual DEA budget runs about $2.87 billion. At its peak, the city of Los Angeles had well over 1,000 dispensaries. It would take as much as 40% of the DEA's yearly budget to investigate and raid this one city alone. That doesn't even touch the millions more it would take on top of this to prosecute. And it certainly doesn't count the massive political backlash that such a federal army on the streets of a U.S. city would create. Fact: the feds don't have anywhere close to the resources needed to stop the states on marijuana. This is why they've backed off. This is why the marijuana strategy is the blueprint for nullification success. It's a common claim that the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution means that federal law is always supreme over conflicting state laws. But this view flips the original legal meaning of the clause on its head. Let's start with the text of the Supremacy Clause itself. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Note the key words, in pursuance thereof. The mere fact that the federal government does something does not give it supremacy. It must find roots in the enumerated powers delegated in the Constitution, and at the same time, it must not violate the Bill of Rights. Alexander Hamilton covered this in Federalist 78. He wrote, "There is no position on which depends clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid." What does this mean in practice when federal and state laws conflict? Well, in general, if the federal law is in pursuance of the powers delegated in the Constitution, federal law is supreme. And in general, when it's not, state law wins. Otherwise, the Supremacy Clause would say this: this Constitution and any other act that Congress, in its infinite wisdom, decides to pass shall be the supreme law of the land. But it doesn't. Federal laws not made in pursuance of the Constitution are not supreme. They're void and should be treated that way too. If you discuss a state bill contrary to federal goals, some will claim it's unconstitutional with just two words, Supremacy Clause. But in many situations, the Supremacy Clause doesn't even apply. The original meaning of the Supremacy Clause tells us that state laws must generally yield to conflicting federal laws made in pursuance of the Constitution. Even so, out of the hundreds of nullification bills filed in states in recent years, the Supremacy Clause only applies to a small handful. The rest generally prohibit the use of state resources to enforce or effectuate federal laws, and the Supremacy Clause doesn't even apply. Here's the deal. The feds have overextended themselves. As the National Governors Association pointed out, they rely on state-level support or enforcement to carry out most federal programs. So most modern nullification bills use the strategy of withdrawing support for them. This is the strategy advised by James Madison and backed up by over 170 years of Supreme Court precedent, holding that the federal government cannot require states to use resources or personnel to help the feds carry out their programs. Known as the anti-commandeering doctrine, states can simply stop participating and leave enforcement to the feds, who don't have the manpower to get the job done in the first place. When states use this strategy, there's simply no possibility of a Supremacy Clause conflict. Think of it like a boycott. A store can't stay in business if people don't shop there. But the store can't force anyone to shop there either. Today, most federal programs can't stay in business without help from the states, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly supported the constitutional framework that the feds can't force the states to help them either. It's the federal government's own problem that they've set up programs that rely on help to implement. Refusing to help the federal government is smart strategy. It's constitutional, it's an easy legal argument, and it works. Some people are fond of saying that nullification can't be done in any form because it's not in the Constitution. But this view flips the entire system upside down. One of the most basic principles of the Constitution is that it is based on delegated and reserved powers. Here's the introductory version. The federal government is only authorized to exercise those powers which have been delegated to it in the Constitution. And states are not allowed to exercise powers expressly prohibited to them. Mostly found in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. As James Madison put it in Federalist No. 45, the powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. If someone says a state can't do something because it's not listed in the federal constitution, they've got the system totally backwards. The next time someone tells you this, don't debate them about the supremacy clause or whether the nullification effort is based on anti-commandeering strategy or anything else for that matter. Instead, start with these basics. It's the federal government that can only do what's delegated to it in the constitution, not the states. People need to learn this fact before they can ever understand anything else. Whenever states take action to resist federal laws, some condescending person is bound to say this was settled in 1865. The nullifiers lost. But they've got it backwards. While some people associate nullification with the short-lived effort of South Carolina in the 1830s, the biggest nullification effort of the time was actually by northern states in response to the Fugitive Slave Acts, a series of federal laws designed to keep the institution of slavery intact. Starting in the mid-1830s and ramping up through the 1850s, northern states passed personal liberty laws to effectively nullify the hated pro-slavery laws from Washington, D.C. These states were so affected that South Carolina named this northern nullification as the number one reason for leaving the Union in their official declaration of causes for secession. The document read, in part, the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. In addition, they noted for 25 years, this agitation has been steadily increasing. Official secession declarations in Mississippi and Texas also protested this nullification of federal slavery laws by northern states. Opponents of nullification often try to associate it with the slaveholding states of the 19th century South by claiming the issue was settled by the Civil War. The implication is that the South wanted to nullify, and since they lost the war, nullification is either racist or illegal. Putting aside the fact that slavery was supposedly legal at the time and the southern states had nothing to nullify, the historical record proves that it was the anti-slavery abolitionists in the North who are actually using nullification. And while winning a war should never be a measure of what's right and wrong, I guess you could make the case that the question was settled in 1865. The nullifiers won. Ignoring definitions of words like nullify, nullification, and null from dictionaries of both the 18th century and today, most lawyers claim the only definition of nullification is the legal one. While a court might be able to nullify a law by striking it down, I can also nullify the positive effects of exercise by eating too much pie. When it comes to state nullification of federal acts, legal experts seem to think only of courts and never of pie. They believe that states are claiming individually the power to overturn a federal act in law as if it were repealed, even when states aren't trying to do such a thing. In fact, this idea has never been more than a theory. It has never happened, ever, and we should never expect it to happen either. On the other hand, the other definition of nullification, that is, nullification in effect or in practice, has happened through state actions, is currently happening, and will likely continue happening, even though the legal experts would like you to call it something else. In the 1850s, northern states took various approaches, primarily withdrawing material support or resources to the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. South Carolina, Mississippi, and Texas all considered these acts of nullification, even though they didn't fit the lawyer definition of the word. Today, nearly 24 states and counting have legalized marijuana for either limited medical or general recreational use. The Supreme Court didn't favor them in a 2005 opinion. And all branches of the federal government still consider the plant illegal. None of these state actions have overturned federal prohibition in law, and the federal government aggressively tries to stop them. But as more and more states and people do what they want without federal permission, Washington, D.C. has had to back down, and they'll continue to do so until they've totally lost. This is nullification in effect. In the end, if the states continue pushing back and the feds back down, the lawyers can call it whatever they want, and we'll call it what it is, nullification. Some people say an 1830 letter from James Madison proves he opposed nullification in all situations. Nothing could be further from the truth. Writing to Edward Everett, the father of the Constitution used phrases like overturn the first principle of free government and speedily put an end to the Union itself. Most modern commentators and legal experts claim Madison was talking about nullification with a broad stroke. Because of this, they also claim nullification is always wrong and should never be used in any form. Fact, they're either ignorant or lying. Everett asked Madison about a nullification doctrine proposed by John C. Calhoun for the state of South Carolina. In order to understand Madison's response, though, we must first understand Calhoun's proposal, which covered three main points. 1. A state could declare an act of Congress null and void. That declaration would be conclusive, and the feds would have no legal right to enforce its view. 2. After the state exercised this right, the federal government would have a duty to immediately abandon enforcement of the act, at least in that single state. 3. If the federal government disagreed, it would have to apply to the other states for approval, and only if 3/4 of the states supported the federal act would the nullifying state lose. History and text both revealed the truth about this doctrine. It was never proposed or discussed by the founders at the Constitutional Convention. It was never debated in any of the state ratifying conventions. It was simply made up by John C. Calhoun. James Madison rightly rejected it, but his rejection was of this specific doctrine. Writing to Everett, he called it the expedient lately advanced. And later, in his notes on nullification, he again rejected this specific doctrine of South Carolina. Claiming Madison's rejection of John Calhoun's bastardized, made-up South Carolina version of nullification meant he rejected nullification in every situation is a lie. That's like calling a no dessert before dinner rule for your kids the same as telling them they can't eat at all. Did you know that James Madison advocated for nullification even in writings that are commonly pointed to claiming he opposed it? In his famous 1830s Notes on Nullification, James Madison railed against a specific nullification proposal from South Carolina, claiming the power of a single state to legally overturn any congressional act. Drafted by John C. Calhoun, the proposal also claimed that the federal government would immediately have to obey a single state, declaring a federal act unconstitutional, and could only stop this process by getting 3/4 of the states to overturn the action of the nullifying state. Mainstream conservative and liberal experts take this out of context and intentionally misconstrue Madison's opposition to what he called the doctrine of South Carolina. At the same time, they conveniently forget to mention Madison's other statement in support of nullification in that same document. He wrote, "The right of nullification meant by Mr. Jefferson is the natural right, which all admit to be a remedy against insupportable oppression." Further proving that Madison was rejecting the specific doctrine of South Carolina and not nullification in general, he added, "It cannot be supposed for a moment that Mr. Jefferson would not revolt at the doctrine of South Carolina." On the other hand, the phrase "all admit" couldn't be more clear. James Madison indeed considered nullification a remedy against insupportable oppression. Both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison recommended being strategic about stopping federal power in the states, but they differed in what qualified for the strongest level of resistance. In 1798, Thomas Jefferson advised each state to take measures of its own to ensure that federal acts not authorized by the Constitution would not be exercised within their respective territories. Jefferson felt that any time the federal government went beyond the Constitution, each state should immediately take steps to stop enforcement of such acts. He said each state should nullify of their own authority all assumptions of power by others within their limits. But Jefferson was no dummy. In a letter to James Madison, he advised being strategic about it too, suggesting they push as far as events will render prudent. J. James Madison was even more pragmatic. Writing in Federalist 46, he recommended a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. The Supreme Court repeatedly supported this as the anti-commandeering doctrine in a series of cases from 1842 to 2012. Madison only recommended going beyond mass non-participation and using a more confrontational approach in extreme situations. While Jefferson was willing to go as far as strategically possible on any federal act perceived to be outside the scope of the Constitution. The goal for Jefferson was to stop the enforcement of such federal acts within the boundaries of the state. Today, James Madison's pragmatic approach can effectively achieve Thomas Jefferson's goals. The federal government is involved in so many areas of your life, it has to rely on states to carry out most federal programs. Because of this, states have a powerful and effective strategy at hand. They can take measures of their own without having to get permission from anyone outside their state. They can use a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union, backed by modern Supreme Court precedent, to effectuate a practical nullification of most federal programs. But if such methods fail to stop federal power, the principal author of the Declaration of Independence and the father of the Constitution both agreed that stronger steps should sometimes be taken. As James Madison put it, nullification by any means necessary is the natural right, which all admit to be a remedy against insupportable oppression.